this is Arthur Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, they happen to be the views of our special guest this evening, Joel Skousen, editor of World Affairs Brief, and certainly one of my favorite guests, and I'm sure you're one of your favorite guests as well. So with that as a background, hi, Joel. How are you doing this evening?
I'm just fine, Dr. Stan. It's good to be with you again.
All right. Well, I'm just going to let you pick up the story from there.
Well, thank you. As you know from our previous radio interview, I'm showcasing this week kind of an update on where we stand in terms of the JFK assassination. It's been many years, and a lot of water's gone under the bridge. And it's actually been many years since I've really focused on it, and brought to my attention by one of my new subscribers to my brief ended up being William Dankbar, who runs one of perhaps the foremost site now on assassination investigations called JFK MurderSolved.com. JFKMurderSolved.com, and he has brought me up to date on a lot of the research that he's financed over the years and the continuation of Mr. West, I believe it's Joe West, investigation. And much of this I'm pleased to say you were familiar with before in terms of the new videotaped evidence from the actual assassin of the headshot to President Kennedy, who has now made public his confession and named names, as well as one of the prime CIA mafia insider men who provided false IDs and many of the supplies and weapons for the assassination attempt. And so we have some major breakthroughs in this case, and so it's good to at least give my readers an update on that.
All right, fine. Well, you go right ahead. And I think one reason I think this is important is the fact that it shows how clever they are and how ruthless they are and how they've been able through the years to suppress the truth about President Kennedy's assassination. And if they were able to suppress the murder of an American president, what are they keeping from the American people now under the guise of national security? And, of course, it calls to mind of the recent attack on the World Trade Center, where, of course, we had a special investigation, the 911 Commission, and the testimony of 1,100 of the people who testified before the commission in secret, in private, was sealed for 50 years so the American people would never find out what happened. And to this very day, so much of the information surrounding what happened when President Kennedy was killed, that is still classified and a secret. We can't let the American people know because they might tell Lee Harvey Oswald or something ridiculous. This is all an effort to use the guise of national security to conceal the truth from the American people.
Well, one of the reasons that they seal up the evidence is so that, for two reasons. One, the evidence itself is pretty damning that the official story is false. That's the way it was, and with the record of Martin Luther King, Oklahoma City bombing, 9/11, JFK assassination. But it also would highlight and showcase the fact that the government knew this evidence was, or the official case was false. They saw the evidence, took it in secret testimony, and then covered it up. It becomes very obvious there's a cover-up if you see the kind of open evidence that they actually had in their hands when they made the phony conclusions they did in their reports. Whether it's the Vince Foster cover-up, what people have to realize and why this is important. A lot of people say, well, why can't we move beyond this? You know, we're not going to bring Kennedy back. Why do we have to bring this up? The reason is very important.
You're going to have to be hold just for a moment. We'll be right back. Go right ahead.
The reason is very important why we study conspiracy, why we study cover-up, and that is that cover-up is about the closest we're going to get to be able to putting together the case that there is a broader conspiracy. And let me explain in general this way. We're never going to get anyone from the top levels of a conspiracy, and there are really only very few that really know the whole general intent of the conspiracy to take down American liberty and national sovereignty, and it's actually take down world liberty and put us under a new world order. I'm a firm believer there is such a conspiracy, but I'm also just as firmly convinced that it doesn't take thousands to run that conspiracy, that it only takes probably less than 100 of people who really know who the principal players are and what the real total agenda is. And the rest are a combination of predictable yes-men. They're very expert at hiring people. They won't have to say, look, there's a conspiracy, this is why we have to do that. They don't want to hire people that they have to threaten to do them. They hire people who they watch carefully and they see are predictable, that they can just give mild hints to, and they'll carry the ball. I mean, this is no better illustrated than the environmentalist position. There is an environmentalist conspiracy to take away property rights and to undermine property rights and use environmental crises as an excuse to have government intervention in the rights of private property in the name of protecting the environment. That does not mean that everyone involved in the environmental movement is conspired to take away property. There are literally hundreds of thousands of sincere environmentalists who simply can be fed an information like the phony global warming thing with a few well-placed key scientists who are unprincipled enough to falsify the data or to put into computers certain parameters that will show the desired results, and you've got hundreds of thousands that will follow along and clamor yes. So it's very, very easy to use predictable people. Obviously, you have to have some people who are semi in the know, who know that there's conspiracy. Some of those people have been told it's benevolent, that we need to control people. People are stupid. You've got to be able to tell them what to do. And you can't tell them the real reason why we're doing it, for their own good. There's lots of reasons out there. You also use a great many people in government who are used to working under national security rules and laws. Need to know. If they start to ask questions, you just say it's secret. And we can't tell you. You don't have a need to know. And they're trained to shut up. They're trained not to ask questions. For those that accidentally see too much, you have to tell them, look, we can't explain it. It's a matter of secrecy.
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Joel Skousen, and he's simply pointing out that there probably are not more than 100 people at the very top of this world conspiracy, but there are an awful lot of people that go along with it simply because it's a way of getting ahead. Other people are just are told that what we're doing is very good, but you better not find out about it. You're just going to have to go along with this, but it's all for the public good. After all, we certainly like to have a better world. Everybody wants a better world, and we know what we're doing, and the information you want to know is classified for your own good. So pick up the story there.
So what we end up here is you have an awful lot of conspiracy debunkers in the world who make the big case, look, this worldwide conspiracy would have to be so big and control so many things. It has to control the press. It has to control the CIA, the FBI, Congress, the presidency, the courts, and it couldn't possibly exist without it leaking out. And my answer to that is, first of all, I've given many of the answers of how a conspiracy operates at various different tiers or levels, with only a very few at the top actually knowing. Most people don't want to know that there's a conspiracy, even though they may be involved in it, even though they may suspect it, because they're more interested in simply getting wealthy, and of course, the conspiracy offers rewards for every one of these people so that they don't have to use threats. But they do use threats when necessary. They do kill people when necessary. In fact, they kill people on a, not a regular basis, but on a less than irregular basis, certainly, just to send a message to those that are observing to say, this is what happens to people who get too nosy or ask too many questions. Yeah, that's the way the mafia has always operated, and obviously it's the way that every large conspiracy has to operate. It also takes advantage of a great deal of believability of the public. The public is very willing to believe in one of few bad apples. And it's very easy for the news media, who is obviously colluding with government to cover up these things, that they blame things on rogue agents, whether it's Oswald, whether it's the shooter of Martin Luther King, escapes my memory right now what his name was, whether it's Sirhan Sirhan. It's very easy when the media continues to parrot what the official story is for people to walk away and believe. Or like the police corruption in Chicago or Los Angeles. They always have a scapegoat. They always have two or three underlings, but never the higher-ups who authorized, who okayed, who looked the other way. What people need to understand is that corruption in this country is not just a series of greedy people and rogue agents. It's systematic within the system. And nothing points this out better than to look at a cover-up. This is why cover-up is the best evidence of conspiracy, because conspiracy implies that you have collusion between people who have a fiduciary responsibility within government not to collude. In other words, there's independent branches of government, police, courts, justices, executive, legislative branches and things, and none of them are supposed to be meeting and colluding about an onward result. They're all supposed to be following their own individual mandate by law without collusion. And when they collude to get a result that is not legal, that is a conspiracy. And every cover-up involves extensive collusion. Whether it's the whistleblower who sees the cover-up and is put down by being arrested on a trumped-up charge, he goes before a judge, and the judge denies his ability to defend himself, or does other procedural things, which is obvious that he's violating the laws or the standards of justice and jurisprudence. You know that judge has been contacted. There's been a telephone call in the night. That's collusion. That's conspiracy. Or it's when CIA agents get cold feet, or they get taken down, or the CIA decides they want to discard them. The best way to discard people who have been dark side agents or undercover agents, you send them out on an illegal activity. You notify the police anonymously. They go out and find the person in the act. They arrest him. And when he goes before the judge, he says, I'm on assignment from the CIA. And the CIA walks in and says, we never knew the man. And he brings out, then if the defendant has been smart and has squirreled away a lot of evidence that he does work for the CIA and brings it out, the judge then says, that's inadmissible. The government isn't a party to this. You're, you know, guilty, or you're accused of violating a certain criminal statute, and the government has nothing to do with it. But, of course, it does have very much to do with it if he was, in fact, working for the government and under assignment for doing the act. It's a very excellent defense. So whenever a judge, as in the case of Manuel Noriega, throws out all his evidence, first-hand evidence about CIA orders and involvement to Manuel Noriega running drugs in Panama on behalf of the CIA, you know that judge has been touched. You know that he's part of the system of systematic collusion. So that's why cover-ups are so very important. In the JFK assassination, we can look at that Warren Commission, and we can see the systematic cover-up, the intimidation of witnesses, just like what happened in the Vince Foster hearing under Kenneth Starr. It was actually certain FBI agents, which he hired to come in and run the investigation, which did all the intimidation so that Ken Starr, who hardly ever went to the special investigator's office, so that he could be relatively free, having to maintain his Christian image, could be free of the cover-up. And they often like to take good Christian people or people with Christian credentials to front for these people so that they're beyond dispute. I mean, these people are ruthless. They'll do anything. They have no principles whatsoever. And I'm not saying that these people who are Christians are totally guilty. A lot of times they're guilty of blindness, of looking the other way, of not wanting to ask questions, of not wanting to believe, willing to be used by the government because they are promised, perhaps even for their cause, that you know, that there's going to be certain benefit if I play along with the establishment. There's just an awful lot of that happens in the political realm, too. It's not that 75% of Congress is directly controlled by the establishment, but they are effectively controlled by a multitude of these types of pressures, of these types of inducements, of incentives. You know, hardly anyone can get elected or who has the money to get reelected when you have to run a campaign every 2 years for Congress, unless you get the pressure taken off of you by the offer of these constant influx of contributions from the major corporate donors. And, of course, the two major party establishment control all of the major donors. And there is a central insider-controlled group of people that control both major political parties at the very top. Now, that isn't to say that all major parties, that everybody within the Republican establishment or Democratic establishment knows of this collusion. I believe that most people really believe they are fighting each other and that they have a difference in philosophy. But certainly when we look at what's happening in the Iraq war with Nancy Pelosi and all of her cadre of Democrats who keep vociferously criticizing the president yet do nothing to actually stop him from proceeding, just as President Bush did nothing to stop what President Clinton had put into power during his administration, which he could have stopped and overturned when he became into office. This is a part of playing the game, the great fraud and deception of opposition in life when there is no true opposition. So that's why it's good to take a look once in a while back at conspiracy, because in these cover-ups that occurred, like in the JFK assassination, when so many years passed, we do have people come out. Now, to go back to the specific story, in the 1990s, Jack West was able to get, through the help of an FBI agent, a retired FBI agent, Zachary Miller, to get the confessions of two CIA mafia hitmen or facilitators, Chauncey Holt and Jimmy Files, James Files. James Files happens to be the shooter from the grassy knoll in the JFK assassination plot. And he is able to tell how he did it in this taped interview, and it's all available now on DVD from the JFKMurderSolved.com website. I highly recommend that everybody get these videotaped testimonies. I've done a specific review at the request of William Donkbar, the owner of the website, of these two videos, and I'll tell you, I find them very, very credible. And I can tell you why they're credible. If a person's making it up or playing some kind of game, they'll be hedging. They'll be too careful about what they say. Or sometimes they'll claim to tell too much. They'll claim to know more than what they could know. These people are absolutely credible for the first place. They don't understand the whole picture. They did have limited knowledge, and they still have limited knowledge, even though they've read and studied a lot about the assassination, having been a part of it. But at the time, they were just following orders, and they were very limited. They didn't even know how many other teams were out there, how many shooters there would be. They knew that there would be at least one or two, but there ended up being more than even were part of the party that they controlled. Now, that's part of the cellular structure, the composition of hit teams and how they operate. But one thing is very clear from both interviews, from Chauncey Holt and from Jimmy Files, is that they both worked for the CIA as well as for the Mafia. And that the Mafia knew they worked for the CIA, and the CIA knew they worked for the Mafia. And that there was complete coordination, and they named names. That's another sign of credibility. Now, why haven't they come out sooner, and what convinced them to reveal their role in the JFK assassination? One of those was the fear of retribution. They had to wait many years before the people who had control over their lives had died before they felt free. So we get a very interesting picture from them after they name names, and they name names within the government and the CIA who their particular controllers were. And it's very important because this information can be traced.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment or two with Joel Skousen. And I think it's so vitally important that we understand the past. It was George Santayana who said so well, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. What really happened on 9-1-1? Well, we've been told lots of stories, but of course the 9-1-1 Commission took testimony from 1,200 people, 1,100, over 1,100 was in secret, and those files were sent to the National Archives to be sealed for 50 years so the American people wouldn't know the truth. Go right ahead, Joel.
Well, as I said, I'm talking about the credibility of these two hitmen in the video testimony that they gave. One of them, Chauncey Holt, died 8 days after his testimony, and the other is still alive, Jimmy Files. Both of them are very, very interesting. You know, it might be interesting just to describe the contrast. In the DVD on the testimony of Jimmy Files, you talk and see a great deal of the interview with Zachary Miller, who was the FBI agent who put the investigators on to Jimmy Files and finally tracked them down into prison. He knew from inside contacts that he was a suspect, a mafia hitman who was in Dallas at the time of the assassination. The government knew that because the government had brought him down there through the CIA, and that stuff leaked out eventually into where even some of the white side agents of the FBI found out, like Zachary. But it's very interesting to watch the testimony of his supervisor, Mr. Stillwell. Now, Mr. Stillwell, of course, is one who first got bits and pieces of the evidence, the investigation that Zach Miller was working on through official channels in the FBI. And, of course, Zach Miller was shut down and was told not to pursue this once it became evidence that he was coming up with a different conclusion than the Oswald theory. And this was well after, you know, Oswald was dead at Ruby. This was some 20 years after, when Congress periodically reinvestigates these things. But it's very interesting, if you see the interview of the supervisor, you can tell this is a man who realizes that what Zach Miller has come up with is true, but he can't admit it because he was part of the establishment in the FBI. He's still covering his back. He still wants access, and so he's being oh so every careful about playing up to Zach Miller because he's on film with the JFK assassination, playing as if he's friendly to the field and yet being very careful, hedging his bets. He's him-hawing. He's just too careful. It's just in stark contrast to these actual assassins who are sitting there rattling off the data, not thinking, not being careful about the words that they say, not thinking too long, have excellent memories, obviously very, very sharp, very, very believable. It's just too hard to be scripted. They don't claim to know more than what they could know. A lot of times it says, I don't know. I don't know what happened here. But they just are willing to name names. They're willing to tell who did this. And the collusion between the FBI and the mafia is way too much from these interviews to be just a quick marriage of convenience. You know, the CIA, if they ever get accused of being involved with the FBI with mafia, and several charges have come out over the years, as I've covered in the World Affairs Brief, and the FBI headquarters are always quick to say, well, we, of course, had some dealings with the mafia in order to get information on criminals, because the mafias know the criminal element, and the public nods their head. So they always have these superficial excuses to kind of divert the public. But the closer you get into the actual facts of what happens, you'll see this is an ongoing relationship where there's money exchanging hands, where there's people flowing in and out of the CIA underside, or the dark side of the CIA, into mafia and back and forth, and most of them working simultaneously for both sides. And what's interesting, of course, is that both Files and Chauncey Holt talk about the relationship between the higher-ups, the Giancanas and the Licolettis and the Livolettis and the other mafia bosses that, you know, and who was really running the show and who had contact with the CIA and who the mafia.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joel is simply pointing out that the CIA and the mafia worked very, very closely together. People really find that so hard to believe, that the CIA and the FBI would work together on many issues, and there's always justification, always an excuse for it, oh, we had to get information. But the truth of the matter is, the FBI has covered for the CIA, pardon me, for the mafia for many years. We have a wonderful book we carry called Double Cross. It was written by the brother of the head of the mafia. The author is Chuck Giancana. His brother was Sam Giancana, who was involved with the Kennedy assassination. And his brother writes a story, Double Cross, which we do carry, is still available, telling about how the mafia was consistently carrying out assassinations in this country or arranging them in other countries for the Central Intelligence Agency. But we can't let the American people know that. So pick up the story there, Joe.
One of the best kept secrets, and one of the things that you won't find in any of the assassination literature, is a correct understanding of the nature of the split personality within federal law enforcement agencies. In every single one of them, there is a dark side and a white side. And what I mean by that is that there are dark illegal activities done by every federal agency, CIA, FBI, DEA, INS, and there's tremendous infighting between these. One of the reasons for the infighting is that every one of these agencies have legitimate functions to perform, and they hire a lot of white guys, and I don't mean color of their skin, I mean guys that are straight, patriotic, wonderful people. For example, you know, a lot of people complain that in the CIA and the FBI, they hire a high proportion of Mormons in these two agencies. And there is a very high proportion of Mormons. And one of the reasons they do so is that Mormons are trained to be trusting, patriotic, trusting of leadership. They don't question as much as many other people. They make good yes men in many regards. And they're a little bit naive about government as well. So you put them in on the white side, and they become inveterate defenders of the government. I've talked to many Mormons who are in government, and they know of my theory about conspiracy and dark side, and they said, look, we work in the government, Joel. It couldn't exist, or we'd know that. I mean, this is extremely naive that they feel like, with all of the secrecy, with all the compartmentalization, with all the need-to-know laws, that they would claim that they would know. I mean, it's impossible. I was in the military. I had top-secret clearances. Every time you go into a different level, you run up into this wall, you don't have a need-to-know. Even though you got a top-secret clearance, you can't know this stuff because you don't have a need-to-know. There's nobody in their right mind would make that statement unless they were being simply apologetic for government, that I'm in the government, I would know if there was a conspiracy. Nothing could be more naive. But it's just these kinds of people that are in the white side of these federal agencies that make good defenses because they're believable, they're charismatic, they're kindly, they're honest, most of them. And most of them will shut up if they're told not to tell about things that they don't need. So one of the biggest deficiencies, and I'll tell you why I think there's this deficiency among the JFK researchers, is they don't understand that there's a split. Too many of the people, in fact, I would say it's 99.9% of everybody within the JFK investigative assassination movement comes from the left side of the political spectrum. They are fans of JFK. They're looking for the killers. They want to bring people to justice. And uniformly, they work under the incorrect and erroneous presumption that anybody who would kill JFK must be some right-wing wacko, must be some anti-JFK type person, when in fact, they fail to look at the broader picture. I mean, sure, it's very easy to look at the specific interviews given by Jimmy Files and Chauncey Holt. These people didn't like Kennedy. The mafia didn't like Kennedy. And so they say, look, these people hated Kennedy. They had the motive because they felt like Kennedy betrayed them. They helped Kennedy get elected by throwing the elections in Kentucky and in Chicago for Kennedy, which gave him the amount of electoral votes he needed to... I'm sure they threw part of the election in New York, etc. And then they felt betrayed when RFK, Robert, got to be Attorney General and started to prosecute mafia people. But I think really what happened is that the powers that be, who talked the mafia into throwing the election in the places they controlled these election machinery, into throwing it to Kennedy, they set them up for betrayal so that they would feel betrayed by Kennedy, because they knew that they were going to eliminate Kennedy and make a martyr out of him. I'll explain that a little later after the break.
All right, well, I think it's so important. The point Joel is going to make is the fact that Jack Kennedy's great society would never have passed had he not been assassinated, become a martyr, and once he was a martyr, then these wonderful socialist programs that were designed to change America were passed into place and became law. Well, Well, Joel, forgive me for stealing your thunder, but I wanted, of course, the listeners to our stations to hear that. Of course, we have our certainly our people listening on the Internet and people listening on shortwave now who are listening to our conversation, but there's about 3 minutes that's blocked out on our 9 stations that are hearing the program, so you go right ahead.
Well, that's good that you explain to me how these things work.
Well, that's my job, is to make the program run smoothly while you do all the work. I love having you as a guest, Joel, because I don't have to do much of anything here. Go right ahead.
I'm happy to take some of the load off you. Certainly, with 5 hours a day on the radio, I wouldn't envy that kind of a schedule, Dr. Stan.
I love it. I really do. Once in a while, I get a chance to talk, but you go right ahead, please.
We certainly appreciate your efforts. But my point is this, is that because these people come from the left, that they like JFK, they like what he stood for, they think that he was benign, they fail to realize this person was a total puppet of the establishment. All of these rumors about him bucking them, are just so much folderol. JFK was worried first and foremost about who he was betting in the White House that night. And secondarily, he was worried about his image and what history would look. So he was... Sometimes he would buck his advisors because he was worried about his image, not because he had any principles. If you read his history, Jack Kennedy was strictly a womanizing man with a big ego and with a great powerful machine behind him from his father, Joe Kennedy, made all of his money in bootlegging, with mafia connections, of course, and later got into government connections. But these powers that be, these insiders, put Jack Kennedy in office not because they were sold on Kennedy or because Kennedy was going to be a president, but because Kennedy was going to be a puppet, a very charismatic one, who was going to move the nation forward towards socialism, which is one of their globalist agendas. What the Kennedy assassination people fail to realize is that the same people who killed Kennedy, the same movement, and it's systematic in government, is still there. And Kennedy wasn't the end-all. It had to do with Martin Luther King. It had to do with Bobby Kennedy being assassinated. And these things have one consistent thing is, by assassinating these people, they gain more from them than they could have had them by staying alive. They gain 10 years on the Civil Rights Movement by killing Martin Luther King early. They gained 10 years on the socialist agenda in America by killing Kennedy so that his great society, as you just said, could be implemented through Johnson. And it was a rubber stamp, naming everything from Cape Canaveral to Kennedy and city streets after Martin Luther King and national holidays. None of that would have occurred if you hadn't killed them, because they would have been discredited within a few years.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. And Dr. Stan and our guest this evening is Joel Skousen. And before we go on, Joel, I do want you to give your telephone number, your website, and tell people a little bit about the World Affairs Brief and certainly why they should want to get it.
Well, the World Affairs Brief is my weekly news analysis service where I cover these kinds of issues that we're talking about tonight. On my website, which is www.worldaffairsbrief.com, www.worldaffairsbrief.com, you can get a complete rundown on all the day's news that my researchers post on the website, plus read about a lot of the archival material about, and I especially concentrate on what analyzing government cover-ups, and that's on the right-hand column. So there's a lot that's on the material for free. My weekly World Affairs Brief does have a modest subscription price to it for a weekly analysis of the news, and if your listeners want a sample copy of that to peruse to see if they'd like to subscribe, they can certainly email me at editor@worldaffairsbrief.com. That's editor@worldaffairsbrief.com, and request a free copy of the World Affairs Brief, and I'll be happy to send it out. Friday will go out this particular edition, where I'll have this information about the Kennedy assassination and many other things that I'm focusing on in this week's news.
Well, let me encourage people to, first of all, go to World Affairs Brief every day and just go down the list of articles, and some you'll certainly want to read, some you may want to copy and keep on file. They do an excellent analysis from another of other sites, so you don't have to spend all your time on the web, and you'll be up to date on most of the really important issues. And then certainly on Friday you'll get your World Affairs Brief, which will give you Joel's analysis of what's going on. It's very inexpensive, and certainly I think one of the finest newsletters we have out there. So let me encourage you to get World Affairs Brief, and of course certainly read it every week. Keep abreast of what's going on. So certainly Joel was basically talking about how Jack Kennedy and Martin Luther King's assassination actually accelerated the agenda. Certainly when they assassinated Jack Kennedy, they made him a martyr, and they were able then to bring in the Great Society. And remember, socialism is simply a means by which you centralize power in government, and the people then who control the government control the people. By killing Martin Luther King, they were able to accelerate the civil rights agenda and take away from the individual the right to discriminate. Now, I believe that discrimination against people by the color of their skin is wrong. However, if we are going to regulate everything that everybody does, then freedom as we know it will simply become a remembrance of things past. So you pick up the story there, Joel.
Well, that's correct, Dr. Stan. You know, there's nothing more poignant to understand how important the right to discriminate is, even though people may misuse it, even though people may not use good judgment in their discrimination. Discrimination, by the way, is a broader word than just race. Discrimination means you have the right to choose who you're going to associate with or do business with. And everybody must have that right to choose. Nothing can bring that into greater focus than what Britain just did, and it's coming to America someday. And they have just passed a law where it is illegal to discriminate in adoption to homosexual and lesbian couples. If you run an adoption agency in the UK now, you must allow homosexuals and lesbians to adopt children, whether the parents or anyone else has specifically. They cannot any longer say, I want them to go to a Christian family. I cannot. You must give them almost a mechanized way, including to lesbian who obviously will pass on that distorted moral view to those children. And that shows how dangerous it is to strip away from people the right to discriminate. And it's all done in the name of race, and they did that through killing Martin Luther King. And just as in the Civil War, we lost the right to secede, which has to be a right, you know. Our government is becoming tyrannical. It is becoming like the Soviet Union. They're going to take us into a new world order, Dr. Stan, and we won't have the right to secede. That's what we lost in the Civil War. That's why when I say the Pledge of Allegiance, I do not say indivisible, because I don't believe it. That was put in when that thing was written after the Civil War as a major propaganda piece, indivisible. I don't mind if it's indivisible by voluntary agreement because we follow the Constitution. But when it's indivisible, regardless of whether or not they trash the Constitution, then I'm against that. Because the very foundation of our country, the Declaration of Independence, when a government begins to violate the fundamental rights of man, you have the right to dissolve that government. And that's gone now. And that's gone, and people pledge allegiance to that fact without knowing it and not understanding what these people have done.
And I think what people really don't understand is this move towards world government has been around for hundreds, indeed thousands of years. And we are living in the most exciting time in history because this whole move towards world government is beginning to consolidate. They control most of the governments of the world, both communist and so-called anti-communist. And all the leaders of all of these countries are ready now to secede national sovereignty to this new world order, and with that, of course, the new world religion, because there really is a conspiracy against Christianity and God as well.
Well, you know, there still are differences. You know, it isn't that everybody is totally controlled. What happens is they're effectively controlled because they hold either the purse string over them or they have film about them being corrupted. That's why the CIA has been very deeply involved in, quote, helping Latin American governments, and they bring in their photos and the cameras and they get ammunition on their enemies. What they don't realize, they're also getting ammunition on the very government they're helping, so that if they turn tail and bulk against what the IMF or the World Bank or the CIA wants them to do, they bring out the photographs. So, well, we got pictures of you with your mistress, too. So, you know, they played this game at the time of Kennedy. J. Edgar Hoover had evidence on John Kennedy and all of his romps in the White House, as well as members of Congress. All of the political establishment he was blackmailing in order to stay in power, because he was a true anti-communist. But he also had these homosexual problems with Clyde Tolson, and the government had pictures of his romps in a California motel. And so it's very, very serious. You know, it can be played both ways. And so that's one of the reasons why JFK protected the conspiracy from being revealed, even though there were several agents. One agent now who was present in the autopsy has come forward completely and made a confession and shown how J. Edgar Hoover and the other higher-ups in the FBI suppressed the fact that the autopsy had occurred before he got to Bethesda, that the casket that Jackie Kennedy brought into the lobby of Bethesda Hospital did not contain the body of Kennedy, and how it had been altered, how the bullet fragments had been taken out. One of the reasons that Jack West wanted to exhume the body of JFK is that the bullets that Jimmy Files used to shoot from the grassy knoll at the president had the hollow points removed or hollowed out and mercury put in it so that it would explode on impact. And it would have mercury fragments all throughout the skull area, and that could have been confirmed by test had the body been exhumed. So there's a lot of interesting things on these films that have been involved. As I was saying, though, the real motive, I believe, even though they made use of the fact there are many people that hated Kennedy, and they brought those people to the forefront to do the actual assassination, I think they did that so that if it were messed up, they had several avenues in which to cover the government involvement. One of them that comes out in the video is the fact that both Chauncey Holt and Jimmy Files knew that the CIA at the last minute had called off the assassination, and that the mafia boss, John Connor, who was the liaison of the CIA, decided to go through it, or said to his shooters, "We're going through with it anyway." Now, I personally believe that that was a ruse that the CIA called off, because they're the ones who organized this. They're the ones who called John Connor and told him, "We want an assassination on the president." They called it off only to be able to sever the relationship, to be able to put total blame on the mafia. For all we know, and of course Files and Holt, who testified, they were just the lowly hitmen. They don't know what the CIA told John Connor. They only know that John Connor told them that the CIA was calling it off, but he wasn't going along with it. But that could have been a ruse for plausible deniability. Certainly we know that the government never used that, because it never came out until now, but they never used the fact that they called it off, because to say that we called it off would have been an admission that they planned it in the first place. You see. But in any case, the fact that the government was totally involved, from a Supreme Court justice on down to congressmen, in this cover-up in the Warren Commission, and the cover-up that went in every other congressional investigation, of which we've had two total now, this is a massive cover-up, which involves everything from the judicial side to the congressional and the executive side. And the Secret Service was involved in the cover-up as well. They went and changed the windshield when they were replacing the windshield on the car, you know, for the museum piece. This is the car that JFK was shot in. They had put a new windshield on, and they had shot a bullet in from the rear to the bulletproof windshield, and realized that there was something wrong with the way that these things looked, and they went and had to change it out twice to manufacture the damage to the windshield that was supposed to. You see, there were bullets to the front as well. There were shooters from the front. The first shot that hit Kennedy was from one of the shooters at the front that Files didn't know about. The second shot from the rear, there were two of those from Nicoletti, another mafia hitman who was firing with a rifle at a building next to the school depository. And he was the same team that had commissioned Jimmy Files to be the backup shooter if they should miss. And they did miss. They had hit Governor Connolly, and one bullet from the overpass area had hit Jack Kennedy in the throat. And that's why he was leaning forward, grabbing his throat where he had been hit. And so when Files shot from the front, made that headshot, the president fell back. And that's the way that the thing went down. And Files was very careful. He wasn't even sure how many shots were fired because he was saying, they told me my instructions are we were going for a headshot, and all I was doing is looking for the headshot, and so I kept hearing a shot, and I'd say, miss, hearing a shot, miss, hearing a shot, miss. By that time, Kennedy had come in front of the sign that was blocking his view, and he said he had only about 30 feet to take the shot, and he took the shot because the head had not been hit. And, of course, he was using a scope on a cut-down rifle mechanism in a pistol-type grip, and he made his shot. It was very, very accurate, very, very trained, well-skilled person using a rifle round, a .222 Remington rifle round with special explosive shell. In any case, it's a very dramatic video. This part of the case, as far as I'm concerned, is closed now. We know who the shooter was. We know who the people who falsified the IDs, which were used among many people who walked up to anyone who had a camera, and this shows that they were prepared for this. They walked up to anyone with a camera and confiscated those cameras, and this was happening within seconds of the assassination. How many of those Secret Service people were in the area? Well, not official, say, Secret Service, a lot of people with phony IDs. And the, Chauncey Holt talked about how they had to get the special codes. They changed the codes nearly daily of little lapel badges that the Secret Service had so that they would know that they were really Secret Service and not faking it. And they had the code of that day, which was delivered them, of course, from insiders within the Secret Service. My point is that this cover-up is at the government level. This cover isn't done by the mafia. This is done within the CIA, within the Secret Service, within the top echelons of government. Now, we don't have anybody from the higher levels of government itself. We don't know who was controlling Johnson. We don't know who was controlling Kennedy. We've never had any of those people come forth, and we never will. But it's very important to understand the nature of conspiracy, to look at the big picture of these cover-ups, and to see, for this and this to happen, could this have been done without very, very high government people controlling the events of this commission, the Warren Commission, as well as the evidence, the intimidation of witnesses, and eventually, of course, the killing of a lot of people who had evidence or who saw things that they weren't supposed to see and became whistleblowers or potential whistleblowers.
Well, I know that our friend Craig Roberts had written a book about over 100 people who'd been killed who knew something one way or another about the Kennedy assassination. Over 100 people, and everybody remembers Dorothy Kilgallen, but there were so many other people, who had seen it having to do with the shooting of Officer Tibbet or other things. And in fact, you even mentioned that there is some film footage by the fellow who actually shot Officer Tibbet.
Yes, that's right. They have the confessor of his name is Plumlee, who admits to having shot Officer Tippett. His orders were to shoot Oswald, and he was working for the CIA.
And, of course, I think people have to understand that Oswald was a government agent. He worked for both the FBI and the CIA. And, this was a very, very involved situation, but Oswald was not the lone shooter at all. In fact, he was a patsy, just as James Earl Ray was the patsy for the assassination of Martin Luther King, as Saran Saran was the patsy for the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Actually, Saran Saran was standing in front of Kennedy. The bullets hit Kennedy from behind.
Yes, and there were more bullets found in that kitchen area, in the woodwork and the cabinetry and the other things, than could have possibly fit within the revolver that Sirhan Sirhan had in his hand. So, you know that there were multiple shooters there, and it's just a setup. There were multiple shooters at the MLK one. Both of these hitmen who were involved in the Kennedy assassination said clearly, no, Oswald was not a shooter. They took paraffin tests. He did not have any of the gunpowder. The only gunpowder he had was on the palm of his hand. And the reason that got on there, he said, is because Oswald went with him when he test-fired his weapons and got his scope, and he told Oswald to pick up the shells, and that's where you put the shells when you pick them up off the ground, and that's where you got the gunpowder in the palm of his hand. Because certainly when you're holding the grip of a rifle, you don't get gunpowder in the palm of the hand. So Oswald was clearly not the shooter. He knew he was the patsy. He knew he quickly suspected he was going to be taken down. The film talks about both people who knew Jack Ruby, knew about his contacts with the mafia and the CIA. And so when Jack Ruby went in there and killed Oswald, he was ordered to do so because Plumlee, the CIA agent, killer, had missed and hit Tippetts and killed Tippetts, and thus had failed to silence Oswald. So it shows, Dr. Stan, these people are utterly ruthless. This is not just a benign conspiracy. This is systematic, and it's very, very serious. It may already be too late for our nation, but certainly not too late to help wake up as many people as we can.
And that's your job and my job. I'm often asked, why did Jack Ruby walk in? And you know, he knew he'd be caught. And, of course, Chuck Giancano tells us that in the book Double Cross, why Ruby was given an offer he couldn't refuse. He was told that everybody in his family would be tortured to death, and he would be tortured to death if he didn't go in and kill Oswald. Well, that's an offer you can't refuse. Could that thing happen? If it's really written by the brother of the head of the mafia, wouldn't you think that it might get in the New York Times or somebody mention it? But they never do. I wonder why. We'll be right back with Joel to wrap up tonight's program. Well, Joel, you have 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, one of the things that I mentioned in our previous dinner that we had today was that one of the prime players in the cover-up of the Kennedy assassination was Arlen Specter, who was assistant in charge of the legal counsel for the Warren Commission. He was the one who conjured up the magic bullet theory. He fed it to Congressman Gerald Ford, who was on the Warren Commission, who was the one who presented it to the commission himself. I mean, this is just a ludicrous theory that you have to be completely involved in the conspiracy to come up with this. And of course, Arlen Specter was rewarded with becoming progressed up through his attorney field, through being DAs and other things, till he became elected to the Senate in Pennsylvania. And since then, he has been masquerading, one of the worst, Dr. Stan, to be challenging the president, to be challenging wiretapping, to pretending to defend the Constitution. His rhetoric is always high, it's harsh, it's high profile, and yet every time he votes for the president, for wiretapping. He works out these compromises, which are slick, which basically give the appearance that the president is giving in a little, but in fact it's a sellout to the very cause. This is the height of this type of conspiracy, to understand that these people will lie to your very face, will pretend to be white sheep when they are black, when they are wolves in sheep's clothing. And this is the great evil that we face, that's so difficult for good Christians and conservatives to believe, is that the very people who are telling them what they want to hear, who pretend like they have political power, or that actually have political power and pretend to be one of us, are in fact on the other side. So willing are people to believe that we have conservatives in government that they're unwilling to throw them out. And one of the most disappointing things, though predictable, that I saw this last week was on NPR. They had the entire rundown of every candidate for the presidency in the Democratic Party and every candidate who's declared or willing to declare for the presidency in the Republican, and they left out Ron Paul, a congressman, and they left him out, and I have to believe it was done on purpose. They do not want the people to know that Ron Paul, the only one who is absolutely honest, is going to be denied the opportunity to debate or even to be known in public that he's running for president.
Well, our job is to let people understand he's running and to encourage them to go to his website every week to get his latest message and encourage them, if they really care about their future and their families, to get involved in this coming election. I think it could be the most exciting election since 64. We're out of time. God bless. Thanks so much for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Joel Skousen. I hope you've enjoyed our talk. Let me just mention that we've been investigating this for a long period of time. We have 2 4-tape sets on the JFK assassination. One is JFK assassination. The other is a JFK update. On the initial JFK 4-tape set, you'll have a 2-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was immortalized in Oliver Stone's film, JFK. You'll really want to hear Fletcher Prouty's explanation of why the CIA killed Kennedy. And then, of course, you'll have an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald, and then you'll have an interview with Dr. Crenshaw, who was in the Parkland Hospital emergency room, his surgical resident, when they brought in President Kennedy, when they brought in Governor Connally, when they brought in Lee Harvey Oswald. And Dr. Crenshaw was told if he ever revealed what he saw, the truth, the fact that the bullets obviously came from the front, why he would never practice medicine. And he waited 25, 30 years and eventually wrote a book and eventually appeared on our program. And it's a fascinating interview. It's the only one I know with Dr. Crenshaw. You'll certainly want to get the JFK assassination 4-tape set. The second 4-tape set includes a 2-hour interview with Madeleine Duncan Brown, who was President Johnson's mistress. And she tells, of course, the meeting the night before where the plans were solidified for the assassination of the President of the United States. And who attended that meeting? And, of course, there were so many key people. But you're going to have to hear the 4-tape set. And we have so much other information on that. We have certainly Kill Zone. We have an excellent book written by Craig Roberts on that. And then, of course, we have, as far as the government and drug smuggling, why we have a 4-tape set. Pardon me, we have a 4-tape set. Is there really a war on drugs? And you'll actually have 6 interviews there. We have a book, Drugging America. Yes, the CIA is involved in drug smuggling, always has been. The book, Defrauding America. The book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye, written by Monica Jensen Stevenson about the men we abandoned in Vietnam, the prisoners of war, and the CIA involvement in drugs. And, of course, they pull this book off the shelves of stores here and across America. I know because I went to a store where I'd seen the book 1 week, and I went the next week to buy it, and they told me they'd recalled the book. Why did they recall the book? Because they didn't want the American people to know the truth. Subsequently, why Monica got the copyright back, went to Canada, where they printed the book again, and somebody just accidentally shredded 5,000 copies of the book. Well, we actually have copies of the book. They're secondhand, but they're in good shape. Kiss the Boys Goodbye, and if you're going to get it, I suggest you get the 4-tape set, which includes an interview with Monica Jensen Stevenson, and tells you about the men we abandoned in Vietnam. Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon simply lied to the American people, and some of them are probably still over there, realizing now they've been betrayed by their nation. And then, of course, we have a fascinating book. It's called Into the Buzzsaw. It contains an interview with Gary Webb, who was a reporter, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for the San Jose Mercury, who wrote about the CIA and drugs, and of course, lost his job over that. CIA saw he would never get a job anywhere in the world again, and blocked him from ever getting a job back in the newspaper industry. And then, of course, he eventually commits suicide by shooting himself in the head twice to make sure he's dead. Shooting himself in the head twice to make sure he's dead. Yes, that's the story of Gary Webb. He shot himself in the head twice to make sure he was dead. And you'll hear him read his essay in Into the Buzzsaw. And then, of course, we have the 2 4-tape sets. One is there really a war on drugs and the men we left behind? Call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so, we'll be back here in just a moment or two. And I just want to mention, we'll be back in a moment or two. Well, this is Arthur Stan back here at Vita Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And well, with us in studio this evening is Mr. Harold Strauss, and he has a fascinating story. But it's really rather almost impossible to believe what you're going to hear tonight, because it's so very difficult to believe that anybody would want to prevent an effective treatment for cancer. After all, what a terrible scourge. Anybody who has ever seen anybody dying of cancer, really it's a heartrending experience as a physician. You know, one reason I became an orthopedist is because I didn't want to become so emotionally involved with the people going through this terrible experience. And when I first had heard, I'd been a doctor probably for 30 or 40 years, I guess it was about 1980, when I had an opportunity to talk to Dr. Dean Burke, who was the head of chemotherapy research at the National Cancer Institute. And he told me at that time that there were lots of treatments. He was specifically speaking of Laetrile at the time. He said, "I'm in charge of chemotherapy research. I've been here for 25 years. Laetrile is a very effective means of treatment of cancer, and of course it's being intentionally suppressed." And I asked him about the program that they had at the Sloan Kettering that said that Laetrile didn't work, and he said they rigged that experiment because they didn't want an effective treatment. Well, that led me on to a series of studies, and of course if you gone to our website, we have a number of 4-tape sets, Why Do We Still Have Cancer, Laetrile, Genocide, and of course we have Carry the Book, A World Without Cancer by our friend Ed Griffin. But certainly Mr. Strauss this evening is going to be with us, and his family, his grandfather, was Dr. Gerson. And Dr. Gerson, back in 1946, had testified before Congress about, of course, treatments for cancer that were being suppressed at that time. And ladies and gentlemen, they are effectively suppressing treatments for cancer today. And you might say, why would anybody do that? Well, because there are too many people in the world. Because if we were to keep all the elderly people alive, it would bankrupt Medicare, and they're going to have difficulty keeping it going anyway. But there really are evil and wicked people out there. Without any further ado, Mr. Strauss, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, now, of course, you've been carrying on your grandfather's tradition, haven't you?
Well, it's my turn now. My mother has been doing it for the past 35 years, and my mother's been... Can you hear me?
Go ahead. You're doing fine.
Yeah. My mother has been generating clinics in Mexico, and now they're spreading all over the world. So right now, the Gerson therapy is being practiced in clinics in California, Hawaii, Japan, and there's going to be one opening up in Spain in the spring.
And, of course, there's been a conscious effort over the last 50 years to suppress this treatment, hasn't there?
Oh, the treatment had been suppressed even before that. When Dr. Gerson was curing tuberculosis in Germany, that all of the tuberculosis doctors who were making such a fortune treating tuberculosis and not curing it vilified him. They vilified him. Just 25 years before he discovered the cure for tuberculosis, Robert Koch had gotten the Nobel Prize for discovering the cause of tuberculosis, the tubercle bacillus. But and so Dr. Gerson, when finding the cure for it, was vilified.
And what was the cure for it at that time?
Dr. Gerson, the same treatment that we use for cancer, for pharmaceutical dependency, for drug dependency, for all degenerative disease. We address these problems.
Hold that thought. Just be back in just a moment. All All right, fine. Well, you go right ahead. You were saying you
right.
you addressed the whether drug dependence or cancer, tuberculosis, or so. How do you go? What is the Gerson treatment?
Well, the problems of all these diseases are they're diseases of deficiency and toxicity, nutritional deficiency, and the toxicity of all of the various different poisons that we are that we're required almost to ingest every day. From pollution to food processing chemicals, from pesticides to grooming chemicals, from makeup and so forth. All of these different toxins accumulate over the years and eventually cause us to be unable to handle disease processes. So what we do is we restore the ability of the body to respond properly to all of these therapies, to all of these threats by flooding the body with perfect nutrition, and at the same time using the most powerful detoxification method that we know about to flush out the accumulated toxins of a lifetime and allow the body to respond properly to the threats.
Now, of course, then what sort of detoxification are you using?
Now, this is the controversial coffee enema.
All right.
Okay, and the coffee enema is the most powerful flush of the liver that we can get, and when you give the body all of this perfect nutrition and flood it with the perfect nutrition, what you end up with is the body will get rid of toxicity very, very rapidly. When the toxicity hits the serum then passes through the liver, which filters the serum filters the toxicity out of the serum. And unless you help the liver to flush the toxicity out, that toxicity can overwhelm an already compromised liver, and the patient can die of the products of his own detoxification. So the coffee enema helps the liver flush out the toxicity that is being filtered out of the bloodstream.
All right, but is there anything else that you're using to encourage flushing this out of the body? Anything, chemical, or is it just the coffee enema by itself?
That's the problem. The problem is that we don't use any kind of pharmaceuticals. We don't use any kind of patent chemicals. We don't use anything like that. We use 13 fresh pressed organic fruit and vegetable juices a day for the hyperalimentation portion. In other words, flooding the body with perfect nutrients. 3 big vegan meals.
Oh, okay, hold that, and we're going to be back here in just a moment as we begin picking up our stations out across America. Our guest is Mr. Harold Strauss. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Sir Harold Strauss, and he is the grandson of a Dr. Gerson, and we've actually heard of Dr. Gerson's work. In fact, we are going to be in our next month's newsletter, this January newsletter, we're going to be publishing something called the Fitzgerald Report. The Fitzgerald Report was compiled in 1952 and 1953. Four members of the United States Senate was actually included in the Congressional Record on the 3rd or 4th of August, 1953. And that report has been suppressed ever since. And why? Because it dealt with the fact that back in the 1950s, there were effective treatments for cancer. One of them was Laetrile. One was Hoxie's treatment, and the third was the Gerson diet. Now, an interesting study in thought control today is you try to find a copy of the Fitzgerald Report. Go up on the Internet, try to get it. Go to your local library and try to get it. Do as I did, call the National Health Federation and try to get it. They told me they'd been trying for years to get a copy of the Fitzgerald Report. Why has it been suppressed? Well, because of the American people realized that there have been treatments for cancer for over half a century that have been effectively suppressed. Why, of course, they might begin to understand the true nature of the evil that we're up against. And for those of you who, of course, I hope you'll want to get our January newsletter, for we simply quote the former medical director of Planned Parenthood, who in 1969 gave a talk, and we have interviewed the man who attended the talk, and Dr. Day said, look, There are too many people in the world. They're going to have to die of something. They might as well die of cancer. They have to die of something. We're going to create new diseases. We're going to withhold effective treatments for cancer. Now, that is such a horrible thing to contemplate. But if you understand that here I have sitting across from me the grandson of Dr. Gerson, who in 1946 was using these treatments and was curing cancer, why, of course, you'll begin to understand that this is not imaginary. And, of course, when you read the statements by people like Jacques Cousteau, who wanted to kill off 350,000 people a day, he made Adolf Hitler look like a piker. We have the UNESCO Courier where he's quoted as saying this, and of course, other people who want to even kill far more than that. Then you begin to understand what we're really up against. You'll certainly want to get our January newsletter, and you can request that, or it will be posted as soon as it's completed here in a couple of weeks. My part's done. The staff will be getting it out. But the Herald is telling us about what this whole treatment consists of. The Gerson treatment consists of coffee enemas, which, of course, are means of flushing the liver. And then, of course, is it 17 fresh juices?
13 juices hourly, all day long. They're fresh-pressed, organic fruit and vegetable juices. The majority of them are carrot or carrot and apple. The rest of them are generally greens and apples. And when you juice that much, you're juicing the equivalent of about 15 pounds of organic materials a day. And so you're giving the patient easily assimilable phytonutrients 13 times a day, in a very easily absorbed way. And so when you give the cells the energy and the nutrients, they will then be able to flush out of the cellular structure, flush out the toxins that they've been accumulating for a lifetime.
So this has been around for half a century. It certainly wouldn't be still around if it didn't work. What sort of results do you get? I suppose you probably get, what, primarily terminal cancers?
Most of the people who appear at our clinic generally have been sent home to die by their own doctors. So almost 100% of our patients are, quote, terminal, unquote, cancer patients. Of those, we can cure about 30% to 40% of them. As a matter of fact, right now, working on her second book with her, with my mother, is one of her stage 4 melanoma patients, who is celebrating this month the 26th anniversary of arriving in Mexico at the clinic with stage 4 spreading melanoma.
Well, now, you mentioned now that there actually are clinics here in the United States. For years, of course, it was not allowed at all in the United States. Everything was done here in California, and it was specifically to discourage this. How then, of course, has the liberal legislature got the laws to the point where you can actually have these clinics operating here?
Actually, it's not quite that easy. The clinics in the United States, in Los Angeles and in Hawaii, are operating generally on other diseases. They operate on heart disease and fibromyalgia, on diabetes and migraine, on a host of other degenerative diseases, for which, of course, we are just as effective. Cancer is just the most severe of the degenerative diseases that we can heal, but we have a list of 1,500 diseases, most of which we have been successful against. So they have a wide variety of diseases they can work on. It's when you touch cancer in the United States, that's like a third rail for the establishment, because that's $160 billion a year business for them, and they don't want any of that to go away.
Well, I think it's really not the doctors. The doctors, you know, they believe what they've been told, what they've been taught. You know, there's only three ways to treat cancer. That's you cut it out, you burn it, or, you give chemotherapy. And unfortunately, an awful lot of people die, and they die unnecessarily. And people have, I've actually met people who were terminal, who'd been sent home to die, and had gone to the alternative treatments, and made a complete recovery and as healthy as you or I are today. And that must if you can certainly save 30% of those who've been sent home to die, that must be very, very gratifying.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's what keeps us going. But beyond that, if we can save 30% of the people who have already been given up for dead by conventional medicine, then imagine what we can do with people who come to us first rather than last, in stage one or stage two. In those cases, we can get nearly 100% response from our patients. But very few people come to us at those stages. They are so totally brainwashed by their doctors that until they are told to go away and die, they don't bother to come down and visit us, try us.
Well, now, of course, you said this is actually spread to other countries. Are these clinics throughout the world?
There are clinics. There is a clinic in Japan, a new one, and there is a clinic going to be opening up in the spring in Spain. And other countries have expressed interest as well, Hungary, the Czech Republic, and other countries.
All right, fine. And of course, it's primarily a matter of diet and then coffee enemas. Is there anything else? What about? Did you give anything in the way of nutritional supplements or vitamins or what about sunshine, things of that sort?
Well, sunshine, if you recall, sunshine is one of the stimulating factors. Radiation is one of the stimulating factors for melanoma. So sunshine, direct sunshine, is not recommended for our patients. But indirect sunshine or a little bit of sunshine when you're totally covered up so that you do get some of the benefits from it in your eyes, but not direct sunlight on your skin, is allowed. But we do give supplements. We give basically natural supplements, supplements of chemicals that are normally found in a healthy body, such as potassium and thyroid and pancreatin, enzymes and vitamins and so forth. Nothing that is patentable, nothing that is pharmaceutical, nothing that is damaging to the human body.
I know there's a gentleman back east who has been using enzymes for a long time, and I know I've talked to people. Do you know Mr. Ralph Mass, who writes extensively on cancer? And he's mentioned, of course, the enzyme treatments seem to be quite effective. Now, is yours similar to the enzymes that are given?
Almost all of the metabolic therapies in use today, including Gonzalez with the Kelly treatment.
His enzymes.
Yes.
Okay, it was Gonzalez.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Go ahead.
Including many others are based on the Gerson therapy in one way or another.
They really are. So that he then using something that your grandfather was using 50 years ago.
75 actually.
75 years ago.
But they've added and they've subtracted and they've added Laetril and they've added live cell therapy and chelation and so forth, but the basis, the underlying basis, the coffee enemas and the pancreatic enzymes and the organic food and salt-free and fat-free diets are the basis of the Gerson therapy.
Okay, and of course, this has been going on for 75 years.
Yes.
And it certainly would never have lasted that long had it not been able at least to help a significant number of people who had been given up by conventional medicine. So certainly I think it's important we know that these alternatives are there. We know that there's been an active effort to suppress them. In fact, the American Cancer Society attacks anybody who really wants to help these poor, unfortunate people, labels them as hoaxes, and yet, why not give it a try? Oh, no, we can't do that. They even have they have organizations, Quackbusters, and you'll find them up on the Internet. And they'll label all of these people, and they labeled Dr. Dean Burke, who I had personally talked to in 1980, 25 years with the National Cancer Institute. Oh, he was crazy. He thought there was a conspiracy to kill people. And actually, of course, Dean Burke was absolutely right. There really is. And if you doubt that, I suggest you go to Alberton, Georgia, and see the Georgia Guidestones and read what's chiseled there in stone in eight different languages, and understand there are people who have a different worldview, different than you and I. Well, I guess it's Harold Strauss. And Harold, why don't you go ahead and pick up this story here? And certainly, at the present time, while you're treating people with chronic fatigue, how effective is your treatment for chronic fatigue syndrome? Because that, here's an entirely new disease, didn't really exist before 1980. When I went through medical school, we never heard of this chronic fatigue. It really, of course, was unleashed about 1980, about the same time we got a new disease called AIDS. We got a new disease called Lyme disease, and we have all of these diseases that are related to chronic, I believe they're related to chronic infections, but of course the body could probably take care of these if it had the chance. But we're not going to give the body the chance, because everything is done to attack the doctors who try to take care of the 2 million Americans who have chronic fatigue, and that sort of overlaps into chronic fibromyalgia. That's one syndrome, and then of course you have the Lyme disease as well. So go ahead.
Any disease that you label chronic, or is automatically considered incurable by conventional medicine. I mean, that's the definition of it. Of the 1,500 diseases considered chronic in the Encyclopedia of Medical Diagnosis and Treatment, we have had excellent success with 99% of them. So all but about 15 of them are very much treatable and very much reversible using the Gerson therapy. In my mother's book, on page 21, there is a short list of 52 diseases that we have had success with. Cancer is only one line item on that. Lyme disease is on there, chronic fatigue is on there, fibromyalgia is on there, diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure is a 3-day problem with the Gerson therapy. Long-term drug addiction, long-term nicotine, cocaine, heroin addiction, all of those diseases have the same underlying cause, chronic deficiency and toxicity. And when you relieve those two conditions, which is the whole goal of the Gerson therapy, when you relieve those two conditions, then the body is able to respond and heal the disease, all disease processes. There's no such thing, you as a physician certainly know that, there's no such thing as selective healing. When anything heals, everything heals.
Well, now, as far as the high blood pressure, you say 3 days?
Yes, sir.
But what happens after the 3 days? Do they have to continue on this diet?
Not the intensive diet. You can, as long as you pay reasonable attention to your input and don't go back to the terrible nutritional habits that most Americans have. So 5 to 10 grams of sodium a day and 140 grams of fat a day and tremendous amount of meat protein and high fructose corn syrup and so forth. As long as you eat organic, relatively mostly vegetarian or vegan and salt-free diet, you'll be able to avoid any of these diseases. Avoid them completely.
And so basically, 3 days, you could actually get the blood pressure pretty well down.
A friend of my wife went down to the clinic with her last year. We like to go down about once a year just for a general flush. Went down there last year. She was already on heavy medication for her high blood pressure, and the medication itself was driving her nuts.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Mr. Howard Strauss. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is Howard Strauss, and certainly we're talking about the Gerson diet, and he was saying that his wife and a friend of theirs had gone down to the clinic for a short stay there and for a flush, and that the friend had been on, do you have any idea how high her blood pressure was?
It was high enough that the doctor was quite alarmed and gave her a relatively heavy medication for it, which was itself very expensive and was driving her nuts with the physical and the psychological effects of it. And she said, I will do anything to get off of this stuff. And my wife said, well, come down with me to the clinic and we'll have you off of it. So within 3 days, her blood pressure was not just normal, because normal is not healthy in this country. Her blood pressure was healthy, so 120 over 70. And she had to throw away the drugs, because the drugs, when added to a person with healthy blood pressure, was driving the blood pressure too low, and she faced the danger of passing out.
Okay. And, of course, the chronic fatigue syndrome, you've had pretty good results with that.
Not just pretty good results. We have had excellent results. All of the diseases on the list that that is on page 21 of Charlotte Gerson's book, The Gerson Therapy, all of those diseases have been reversed, not just stabilized, not just ameliorated, but completely reversed, and the person is healthy now.
Well, now, who runs the clinic? Certainly you live up here in the Monterey Bay area, and is your mom live down there? She
my mother, yes, my mother lives in San Diego, actually south of San Diego, between San Diego and the border. She makes rounds at the clinic with the physicians once a week, but the physicians that she's trained down there, the Mexican physicians down there, who've been with us for 25 and 30 years, they are actually the ones who own and run the clinic. Same thing with the one in Big Bear Lake. The owners of the clinic, we train them, we certify them in the use of the Gerson therapy, and then they can open their own clinic. And if we approve of the clinic, we certify the clinic, we can then send patients to them as well. The doctors themselves own and run the clinic, the Gerson Institute does not.
What is then is the Gerson Institute as such? Is it simply the more or less the certifying organization?
Well, it's a certifying organization. We are also a training organization. We also publicize the Gerson therapy around the world. We lecture. We provide internet media. We provide documentaries and books and literature and DVDs and CDs and so forth so that people can learn about it, and so that professionals can learn about it, and we connect patients up with the most convenient or the most appropriate clinic for their problem, and we see to it that that the patients are able to get there and get the appropriate treatment and get the literature and the media that they need. And then we train the professionals to take care of them.
Well, if somebody wanted more information, is there a telephone number or a website they'd go to?
There is a website. It's gerson.org.
That's G-E-R-S-O-N?
Yes, like person with a G.
All right.
On that website, you can find out all about it. The telephone number, there's a toll-free number. It's called 888, the number 4, and then Gerson, G-E-R-S-O-N.
All right, 8884 Gerson.
That's correct.
All right.
That's a toll-free number. Anyone can call it anywhere in the country. Outside the country, and I know that there's people listening over the Internet outside the country, you have to call 619-685-5353.
Would you repeat that one more time?
Right, that's area code 619-685-5353.
All right, fine. And do you get many people from other countries coming here for the treatment specifically?
Yes, indeed. We get people all the time. It's very interesting going down to the and staying down there, which I enjoy doing myself, because we have people from Europe, from Asia, from Japan, from South America. We have people from all over the world coming to the clinic. So at any given time, about a third to a half of the people are from other foreign countries.
And how many people would there be there at one time?
The clinic in Mexico only has 10 beds. The clinics are generally small in this case, but there are more of them growing around the world.
All right, and of course, people are looking for an answer to these problems. And unfortunately, I believe the answer has been known for a long period of time. It has been actively suppressed. And anybody who would like to, we actually have a four-tape set called The New Order of the Barbarians. The interview is with Dr. Dennegan, who heard Dr. Richard Day, who is the medical director of Planned Parenthood, back in 1969, talking about there's just too many people in the world. They're going to have to die of something. They might as well die of cancer. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Mr. Howard Strauss, and we're just talking about the Gerson therapy. How expensive would it be to be down there, say, for a week? Any idea?
I can give you an exact number because it's a fixed price. The price is a little more than just a regular health spa that you might go to for a week for a fat farm. It's $5,500 a week, and that price is all inclusive. In other words, it includes all medical care, all meals, all medications, all nursing, tests, everything. Plus, it includes a companion to stay in your room with you so that they also learn the therapy and see your response to it so that they can be your support system when you get home. Because this is a therapy that is a lot of physical labor when you get home, and the patient should not be doing that physical labor.
What can you do about somebody who just has just morbid obesity? Will this help people? Some people are just so excessively heavy. And, of course, many of these people have diabetes as a result of that.
We had one fellow come down there after a very severe, almost fatal heart attack. He weighed 298 pounds, and he had a terrible gout that he couldn't move unless he had his pills every day. And he had uncontrollable diabetes. And he came down because his father had been healed of pancreatic cancer. And we started feeding him all of these juices and three large vegan meals. And in other words, since the food is the medication, we don't limit the amount the patient can eat. They can eat as much as they want. We want them to eat. So he never went hungry. He ate as much as he wanted. He lost a pound a day. And he was enjoying the food so much and enjoying losing weight, he stayed for 3 months. And he walked out of there. The gout was gone after the first day, the diabetes after 6 weeks, and at the end of 3 months, he walked out of there 210 pounds, no heart problems, no diabetes, no gout.
Well, I think that's was he able to maintain that pretty well after he got home?
We have no control over what people do when they get home, but it would be kind of stupid not to continue the same kind of lifestyle once you've learned that it can keep you healthy.
And are they then to actually stay on this sort of veg and meals when they get home?
Most do. Some don't. And we sometimes see them back again.
Hold that
yes,
for just a moment as we bring our other stations on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. Howard Strauss, who is the grandson of Dr. Gerson, who I've heard of for many years. And, of course, if you go to some of the websites up there, they will lambaste the Gerson diet. They will lambaste the Laetrile. They will lambaste a Hoxie. And yet all of these people had many, many dramatic improvements, and there is a lot of scientific basis for what they were doing. But you see, there are people out there who have a different worldview. Now, this is not the average doctor. Believe me, I know the doctors. I've seen them agonize and weep over the loss of their patients. But the doctors are never allowed to hear that there are other alternative treatments that have been actively suppressed for half a century. And that's why I think our January newsletter, you'll certainly want to get it. It will be available in a couple of weeks, including a copy of the long sought after Fitzgerald report, which we were finally able to get after finding it was actively being suppressed, and even the National Health Federation couldn't get a copy of it. We have a copy. If you are a subscriber to our newsletter, you will have a copy of the Fitzgerald report, which specifically mentions the Gerson diet. The Fitzgerald report was put in the Congressional Record in August of 1953, saying there were active treatments for cancer at that time, in 1953, they were being actively suppressed. But we can't let the American people know that, because cancer is really such a very large and very profitable industry. It's not profitable for the people who are dying. It's really not even profitable, in many cases for some of our hospitals, because many of our hospitals are having real financial problems because so many of the people are on Medicare, and they do not pay the full tab for Medicare. many times they will lose money on every patient they have. But you can go into the hospital and you can run up a bill of $100,000 very, very readily. The Gerson treatment is quite economical compared with the cost of costly medicines. But the question is, what's going to do you the most good? Well, our telephone number, as you know, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you'd like to talk to Howard Strauss. And once again, I want you to get your telephone number and your webpage out.
Right. The telephone number for the Gerson Institute is 888-4-GERSON, G-E-R-S-O-N. Outside the United States or local to San Diego, it's 619-685-5353. The website is Gerson, G-E-R-S-O-N, .org, org. And there you can find out a lot of information, including watching the Gerson Miracle, the DVD, the prize-winning DVD, online. You can watch it for free.
All right, fine. And basically, what does the video show us?
The video is an examination of the Gerson therapy, the elements of the therapy, including organic food, including coffee enemas, including the supplements, and interviews with some 9 patients who should have been dead a long time ago. It's done by master cinematographer Steve Kruschel, and in fact it won Best Picture at the Beverly Hills Film Festival in 2004. So it's a visual treat as well as an informational tour de force there.
Well, for our listeners, I'm going to be going down to Los Angeles tomorrow. I'll be speaking at the Granada Forum, and I'll be speaking at the Shakespeare Club as well. And I'll be home, of course, on Friday to be with you, but so I won't be here tomorrow. But I know when I'm down in Southern California, I'll be meeting this woman who was sent home to die with pancreatic cancer. Now, the pancreatic cancer is one of the most deadly of all cancers. And, we went to medical school, we learned that, maybe at the most 1% or 2% of the people would survive, a few years with pancreatic cancer. But it was a terrible disease and a terrible, painful way to die. And yet, of course, she's as healthy as she can be after being sent home, certainly by her physician, and the family was told that just to await her death. See, she went down to south of the border. She actually had the Laetril treatment, and basically they, of course, use a lot of the same diet too that you use as well, don't they?
We do use Laetril occasionally as an adjunctive therapy. We don't use it as a main part of the Gerson therapy, but it's sometimes useful for alleviating bone cancer pain, and some other cancers. But if you look at the Gerson Miracle, the last patient on there is a pancreatic cancer patient named Pat Aney from Nanaimo, Canada. And she came down to the Gerson Institute after having been told by her physician she would not live to see her next birthday, which was 10 days hence. She was vomiting mouthfuls of blood from pancreatic cancer. That was when we first saw her. She's on this movie 20 years later, and telling her story.
And, of course, the whole idea is to mobilize the body to heal itself.
That's right.
This is really, the human body is the most amazing thing. And if we just would stand aside and give it the opportunity and mobilize the immune system, the body in some instances, in fact, early on, why, of course, in most instances, would be able to deal with the cancer. But by the time you get done, of course, suppressing the immune system with radiation and suppressing the immune system with chemotherapy, you've so crippled the body's response that it's incapable of really taking care of it on their own. And the whole idea is simply to give the body the nutrition that it needs to heal itself. Now, whatever happened to your grandfather? Did they give him a pretty bad time when he was trying to treat people this way?
They gave him the worst time possible. They suppressed him. They ignored him. They attacked him. They would not let him publish in the United States, although He published readily in Europe. He published dozens and dozens of papers, and they were confirmed by dozens and hundreds of other papers in the scientific literature by dozens of other senior medical researchers. It was just in the United States that he was not allowed to publish after he touched the subject of cancer. And you were talking about congressional testimony not being available. In 1946, he testified before the Pepper-Neely Commission, Joint Congressional Commission on Cancer, July 1, 2, 3, 3 days of testimony. And today you cannot find that transcript of that in the congressional record. So the question is, how much power, how much juice, how much money do you have to actually expunge something from the congressional record?
Well, you're dealing with people who have unlimited amounts of money.
Unlimited.
And it's more, some people will just say, well, it's all for profit. And that's a very, very convenient method of looking at it. But if you understand that there's a much larger agenda behind this, and those of you who have not yet seen my talk on planned population reduction, let me suggest that you get it, and it's available through Radio Liberty or through the Prophecy Club. Understand there are people who look at the world differently than rational people. Or they would think that we are not rational. We don't understand that there is an elite who knows so much better for us than we know for ourselves. And when you understand that, why, you can begin to understand, just catch a glimpse of what really motivates the people who have actively suppressed effective treatments for cancer and kept the doctors from knowing this sort of thing. This is the sort of thing that they would never teach in medical school. In fact, certainly there was a Dr. Ivy. And this was 1950. Well, I first went to medical practice in 1960, but I can remember in the mid-1950s hearing about Dr. Ivy. He had been a well-known, internationally known physician in Chicago. But when he came out and talked about Laetril treatment for cancer, they went after him, they demonized him, they took pictures of his house, and they say, oh, what a terrible person he is. He has a big house. He's in this for the money. He was never in it for the money. He was trying to help people, but any doctor who tells the truth about this is going to come under tremendous pressure. Well, we've got Tony calling from Watsonville, and incidentally, our telephone number once again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And hi, Tony. How are you doing?
Good evening, Doctor. Could you find out or ask if there's a copy of that congressional record available, or somebody made a copy of it?
All right. Do you have access to a copy of the congressional record of your grandfather's testimony?
Yes, I do. I have a microfilm copy of it. I published portions of it in my book, Dr. Max Gerson, Healing the Hopeless, which is a biography of Dr. Gerson. I managed to find a transcript of it, but it wasn't easy. I had to search around the country for about 6 months before I found a library that had a copy of it. It had been literally cleansed from every government repository in the country, except for a couple of them, a couple out of the thousands of repositories that there are. I have a microfiche copy of that. That I did say I was going to bring along. I have to apologize. I forgot. It slipped my mind.
Well,
I will get it to you, though.
Tony, that may sound pretty incredible, but you know, the gentleman, one of our supporters, had written actually to us, and he said he was trying to get the Fitzgerald report. He knew where it was in the congressional record, and you can actually go up on the internet and find the references to it in the congressional record. But when he went to his local library, they didn't have access to it. They went to 10 different libraries, asked each one if they would copy this August, the exact date he had, 1952 congressional record. All 10 of those libraries said that they could not or would not send him a copy. He had spent months trying to track it down. He sent me $50, and he said, would you please find this for me? So I spent a day trying to track it down, and I couldn't track it down either. I went to a friend of mine who's a researcher. He was able to get it for me, and that's why, as I said, the National Health Federation, which is the largest organization for people who are interested in natural healing and natural health, they said that they'd been trying for years to get a copy of the Fitzgerald Report. They couldn't find one either. And so basically everybody who gets my newsletter gets a copy this month, because I want as many copies of this out as we can. So this is really what we're up against. But let's go to Paul, who's calling us from Ohio. Paul, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I was wondering what that diet is, and if there's Gerson offers a book on the diet. I'm 135 pounds overweight. My blood pressure sometimes hits close to 200 on the top and about 96 on the bottom.
All right, fine. First of all, can you answer the question there, please?
So the question is, can the Gerson therapy help you with your problem? And the answer is absolutely yes. The blood pressure is a very quick problem to take care of. The weight it comes off at about the rate of a pound a day if you do the strict Gerson therapy. Consider that the average American eats about 120 pounds of fat a year, and we're certainly not gaining 120 pounds of fat a year. That means that our bodies are just dumping or using or burning or something up to 110 or 115 pounds of fat a year. That means that if you stop putting in all that fat, then you will then your body will just dump and burn and get rid of the excess fat very quickly.
Do you have a book or something out on your diet that, or information on your website, or can I call the number and get a mail out or something?
There is a book. Charlotte Gerson wrote a book called The Gerson Therapy, and it is available on Amazon. It's available from the Gerson Institute, and it's available most of the libraries on the Monterey Peninsula. Where are you located?
I'm presently staying in Ohio right now.
Ohio, okay. Well, you would have difficulty getting it in a library in Ohio, but Amazon.com sells it, as does the Gerson Institute.
At that phone number, 888-4-GERSON.
That's correct.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Okay, anything else, Paul?
God bless you, Dr. Stannon, and the doctor there.
God bless. Thanks very much. Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, once again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And our guest is Mr. Howard Strauss, and we're talking about the Gerson therapy. And this is something that, you know, has been around for a long time. It's still being utilized. It's still being applied, and they have a clinic. Where is that, in Tijuana or where?
The clinic, our main clinic, our first clinic that has been there for the longest is in Playa de Tijuana, which is not downtown Tijuana, but it's on the beach area. So it's on the beach within walking distance of the border, but it's in Mexico.
All right, fine. And your mom goes down there every week just to make rounds with the doctors?
To make rounds with the doctors, talk to the patients. She does a lecture every week. She shows the Gerson therapy documentaries, and basically she just educates the patients about the Gerson therapy.
Well, now you gave me a couple of DVDs here. Now, what are on these DVDs? One of them is called "Dying to Have Known,"
known,
right? And the other is the Gerson Miracle.
Well, the Gerson Miracle was the first documentary that Steve Kroeschel made of the Gerson therapy. He himself is a healed patient. He wanted to give something back to us for having healed him and for having protected and maintained his health, and so this was his way of doing it. After we learned more about him, about his capabilities, and he learned more about us, he made the second documentary, which I think is even much more powerful. But the first one, The Gerson Miracle, won Best Picture at the Beverly Hills Film Festival in 2004. So it's a very artful, artistic, beautiful, beautifully filmed movie, and it also is inspiring and frustrating and heart-wrenching, and it'll leave you in tears at the end, truly.
Well, of course, when you stop and think that there are treatments, they've been around for a long period of time, and they're suppressed, and they're letting people die this horrible death, unnecessarily, it's enough to move anyone to tears. John, are you there?
Yes.
John is calling from Carvel.
Yes.
Do you have a question or comment?
Oh, Dr. Stan. Dr. Stan, to you and your guests, I just wanted to tell you this, that, see, I'm on dialysis. And I've been on dialysis for 10 years. And I go Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Well, for that 10 years, I've been taking, before I leave the house, a quinine tablet that prevents you from getting cramps.
Right.
Now, last week, when I went into the drugstore in Carmel here, they said, no more quinine. It's taken off the market, and there's not a substitute for it.
I know, unfortunately, we'll be back here in just a moment. We're going to have to take our break here.
Yeah.
And John, the government then, in its wisdom, has decided that quinine's bad for you. It's been around for, hundreds of years.
Oh, yeah. Right.
But they're here to we're from the government. We're here to protect you.
Right.
So what are you going to do for your cramps? Do you have any idea?
No.
Why don't you try magnesium?
Would that be good, maybe?
You'd have to talk to your doctor, because I'm not an expert on that, but magnesium is great for cramps. Whether he would let you take it when you're having dialysis, I would think there'd probably be no reason why you couldn't, but I just check to your doctor whether it'd be all right to take magnesium. It shouldn't affect you at all, but you talk to your doctor. I can't give medical advice without knowing all of your things, but magnesium is great for leg cramps.
Well, I didn't know that, so I'll talk to him, but...
Do you have a question for our guest at all?
Just quickly, now, does that mean, would you say it means that in India, Africa, Malaysia, Indonesia, and these places where they get malaria, they're not going to get quinine?
I suspect it. No. I suspect it's just here in this country.
You do?
Yeah, they're a lot smarter in the other countries than we are here. Or maybe they don't have as many smart people in government over there as we have here. Here we have all these people who really want to protect us. They're here. We're from the government. We want to help.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, John.
Thanks for taking my call, and thank the guest of yours.
All right, fine. And you, I'm glad you're over there listening.
Bye-bye. Yes.
Bye-bye. All right, we're just about out of time. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners, Howard?
Yes, the parting thought is these chronic diseases are not necessary. You don't have to have a chronic disease. If you have a disease for more than a year and a half, that means you must be maintaining it in your body with something that you are eating or drinking or doing every day. So they don't have to be in your body, and you can get rid of them. All you have to do is pay attention to what you eat and how you live.
All right, fine. Well, our guest this evening has been Mr. Howard Strauss. He is the grandson of Dr. Gerson, who I've heard of for, ever since I really started looking into alternative treatments. I practiced conventional medicine when I practiced, but I also was aware there were other things out there that the average doctor did not know about. And the reason they didn't know about, because somebody was actively suppressing knowledge. And I will tell you, when I was involved with the effort to try to treat AIDS as a communicable disease instead of as a civil rights issue, I realized there were really people out there who actually were encouraging the spread of a deadly disease. Over 500,000 Americans have died of AIDS in America, totally unnecessarily. You need to get my book, AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic. It will give you an entirely different outlook. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening has been Mr. Howard Strauss, and we've been talking about the Gerson diet. Let me suggest, if you would like to really get some grasp of what's going on, you should read my book, AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic. And then, of course, my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, because that is the next step to an understanding of what's really going on today. We have a DVD and or video called Planned Population Reduction. We have a video on population reduction. We have a 4-tape set on population reduction. And you can go up on our website at radioliberty.com and pull down my monograph there called Planned Population Reduction. Or if you get into the other items, you can ask for that. It was written maybe 5 or 6 years ago. I would if I were to do it today, I would add something to it. But it is certainly the best overview of this field that I know. In fact, I know it's going to be pretty good because my good friend Dr. Lorraine Day actually buys them from us, and she sends those out to a lot of the people that she's sending material to. And Lorraine is right on top of everything going on. The fact that she buys from us our planned population reduction is certainly an encouragement to me. Now, one of the things that you really would want to get would be the four-tape set, The New Order of the Barbarians. That's the New Order of the Barbarians. And it is an amazing four-tape set because it's really based upon my interviews with Dr. Dunnigan, who is a pediatrician in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and then, of course, Randy Engel's interviews with Dr. Dunnigan. It may be a little redundant, four interviews, but we actually have a transcript of that. You need to listen to the talks. You need, of course, to read the transcript. You will find it difficult to believe that this is true. And yet I certainly believe it is true because the talk was given in May of 1969. 2 months later, we actually have the complete transcript of the testimony of Dr. Donald MacArthur testifying before the House Appropriations Committee. Dr. MacArthur worked for the Department of the Army, and there he's asking for $10 million to create an entirely new disease for which there is no immune response. And then he says, you know, some people think we shouldn't be doing this, you know, because it'd be a new method of mass killing, but we want $10 million to create an entirely new disease. It'll take us 10 years. But this will be a new disease, for this is no immune response. And 10 years later, that was in 1979, the first cases of a new disease appeared in San Francisco among homosexuals who were foolish enough to take an experimental hepatitis B vaccine. The disease, 2 years later, was identified and called AIDS. If you look at the areas in Africa where the experimental hepatitis B vaccine was given, it's exactly the same areas that you find the AIDS epidemic. You don't find AIDS all over Africa. You'll find it well localized in certain areas of Africa where the experimental hepatitis B vaccine was given. Would anybody be that macabre? Yes, AIDS is a very efficient means of killing, not as efficient as others. I'm sure they have far better methods. Today you need to get the book, A Project Eileen, written by one of America's most eminent physicians, Dr. Garth Nicholson, will be our guest Friday evening, talking about his experience, you know, coming into contact with the people who are creating these terrible new diseases. There's a book out there, We Don't Carry, called Full Disclosure, written by Gary Null, who actually had a man come to him who was dying, who had been part of the team that had created the AIDS epidemic. The book Full Disclosure, you can get it up on the internet. If these things are true, why aren't you being told this by Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity? Well, pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Remember, if you're in Southern California, we'll be talking at the Granada Forum tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. And then please pray for America. Pray for our leaders, our ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty. For we're truly involved in a spiritual battle being fought on the political and ideological and cultural battlefield, a political battle for the survival of Western civilization.
Tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.